On the eve of another Democratic presidential debate, who's talking about the military? Mobilizing an important demographic for 2020. That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, a reporter for Military Times, tries to get answers from the Democratic challengers to questions related to active duty and veterans issues. We'll hear what he found out. Also, how the president is trying to appeal to military voters, a move one Texas legal expert says undermines military justice. A cheating scandal the size of Texas, the Houston Astros face some tough questions and possible penalties. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this November 19th, 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. It's a reality of life when you have something as big as an impeachment hearing happening in the middle of the day. A lot of our listeners won't be hearing us live since we're being preempted across much of Texas. We're going to be right here doing the news no matter what, so a special thank you if you've downloaded or are listening to us on a live stream right now or one of the stations carrying us later in the day. It means a whole lot to us. How can we repay you for your loyalty? Well, how about some potentially good news? Question here. What's the longest you've ever spent waiting to get your driver's license renewed? Well, now the DPS, the Department of Public Safety, is putting in place a new appointment system and will open new offices too, give raises to existing staff and hire hundreds of new staffers, all in an effort to shorten that wait time. Texas Tribune had reported that lawmakers were determined to force changes because of complaints they've been getting from constituents. Now a $212 million funding boost from the legislature is kicking in, but a sword of Damocles still hangs over the DPS to get this right. Most states run their driver's license programs through their respective departments of motor vehicles, and the DPS has been ordered to do a feasibility study around moving the driver's license program to the Texas DMV. If that review is not submitted by September 1st, 2020, the system will automatically transfer to the DMV the following September. But as the Texas Tribune reported earlier this year, many Texans are doubtful that anything will actually change. How about keeping us posted on your experiences? Shifting gears somewhat, a little later in the broadcast, we're going to be talking about some pardons to members of the military from the Commander-in-Chief. These, seen by some as cynical ploys to win over the military vote for 2020. But what are the Democratic candidates doing on that score? You know, when it comes to the military. With the next debate coming up tomorrow, and so far very few questions about the military, Leo Shane of the Military Times reached out to the Democratic candidates on his own, looking for answers. Leo, welcome back to the Standard.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Anyone you reached out to not respond to your list of questions?
Yeah, we had a few of the candidates who didn't get back to us. Andrew Yang, Tulsi Gabbard, and Kamala Harris didn't get back to us. And I should note, you know, a lot of the candidates have put out their military and their veterans policy stuff, but we haven't seen that discussed on the debate stage. The debates have been focused on broader issues of healthcare, on taxes, on a lot of other things. This commander-in-chief aspect, you know, a lot of times is tricky for a national audience to understand and to get into. And so that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to reach out and just get some answers for our audience, get some answers for that veterans community to find out where people stand on things like military personnel policy, their top VA policies, how to prevent veteran suicide, things that really matter to our readers.
Yeah, there are a lot of active duty here in Texas. I think Texas is ranked number one after California. You talk to a lot of servicemen and women. What do you pick up on as the biggest issue for active duty?
You know, troop deployments overseas are always going to grab people's attention, and that's, you know, that's true now as we try and figure out what's going on in the Middle East with President Syria policy, with the recent changes, and in places like Europe and the Pacific. So that's one of the things we ask the candidates. The candidates nearly universally say that they want to withdraw from Afghanistan, that mission needs to end. But we have seen some differences when we talk about the Middle East, Iraq, and Syria. You know, Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg have said that they think that there might need to be a smaller presence there, but there's still definitely a need for U.S. presence. Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker, Julian Castro have said, no, it's time to get out. It's time to really bring those troops back home, stop those sort of open-ended overseas deployments. So a little bit more nuanced than maybe a lot of people think with the field right now.
Very interesting. Now, what about issues related to veterans and veterans affairs? I mean, healthcare has been obviously a much talked about one.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we wanted to ask was just straight up, what's your main veterans priority for folks? And we got a really widespread of things. You know, mental health and healthcare definitely are among top of the list. But we heard from former Vice President Biden that he's worried about for-profit colleges victimizing veterans and focusing too much on that. Julian Castro and Cory Booker both brought up homeless vets as their top priority.
That's an issue that
has seen a lot of progress in the last few years, but it has sort of stalled. You know, we still have about 38,000 homeless vets across the country. And then the issue of suicide, we knew that was going to be a big one. So we sort of broke that out and asked for candidates specific answers on what they want to do there, how they're going to handle it. Good mix of responses there. Some folks say it needs more money, needs more research. Mayor Pete, who was one of only a few veterans in the field here, said that there needs to be a concerted focus on women and rural veterans. He sees a real gap in the services there. And Amy Klobuchar, who has talked about a lot of addiction issues, said that she sees a clear connection there. And there needs to be a more concerted national effort on dealing with substance abuse problems to help with those. So I think in general, what we're getting here is just a better picture of some of the things that could change, or at least will be, you know, talked about on the campaign trail, maybe not on the debate stage, but things as folks travel down to places like Texas, where there are these really big veteran and military communities,
right.
They'll be able to talk to them directly.
You know, if we've just scratched the surface here, you need to check out what Leo's been writing about. We'll have a link to his latest at TexasStandard.org. Leo Shane, reporter for the Military Times. Great to talk with you again. Thank you so much, sir.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
Between 1999 and 2016, suicide rates rose across the U.S., and in Texas, the increase was almost 19%. That according to a 2018 study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The report also found that firearms were the most common method of suicide. But the CDC struggled to study violent deaths for more than 20 years because of the messy issue of gun politics. Things may be changing, however, in Texas and nationwide. Guns in America's Heath Druzan reports.
Welcome to the first day of training. Let me reintroduce myself. My name is George Austin. I'm the clinical lead supervisor at the Suicide Hotline.
George Austin is with the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline. Tonight, he's in Boise, teaching a new batch of volunteers how to answer calls. Idaho has one of the highest suicide rates in the country, and the majority of those involve a firearm. Austin says, like many states, it faces a lack of resources for suicide prevention.
Suicide still has a stigma attached to it, and that makes it harder for people to openly discuss and often instinctually kind of look away.
But this year, Idaho, Texas, and eight other states are getting an infusion of federal funds to study violent deaths, and many of those are gun suicides. It's part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Violent Death Reporting System, which looks at
death certificates, law enforcement reports, and coroner medical examiner reports. And these three data sources are linked to provide a complete picture of violent deaths in the United States.
That's Dr. Janet Blair, who oversees the CDC program. With these 10 states on board, the CDC is now studying the causes of violent death in all 50 states, plus D.C. and Puerto Rico.
Our case definition for a violent death consists of homicides, suicides, deaths due to legal intervention, deaths of undetermined intent, as well as unintentional firearm deaths.
A large percentage of those deaths involve guns, and that's something the CDC hasn't been able to study much at all in the past two decades. That's because of something known as the Dickey Amendment, which passed in 1996. It stipulates that no CDC funds can be used to advocate for gun control. But it doesn't spell out what that means. It's not actually a ban on studying guns as a health issue, but nonetheless, it stopped just about all federally funded firearm research. But Blair says the Violent Death Reporting System is simply gathering information to help reduce deaths.
So what I can tell you is that although CDC doesn't receive direct funding for firearm-related research, we continue to support data collection activities and continue to document the public health burden of firearm injuries in the U.S.
Whatever the politics, states like Idaho welcome the help. Suicides have been rising across the country, particularly in the Mountain West and Alaska. And there are still far too many unknowns, according to Chris Wilson, the program manager of Idaho's violent death reporting system.
Traditionally, when you talk about suicide data, we can tell you the who, the what, the when, the where. But until the establishment of this program, we couldn't tell you the why.
The hope is that the why will be in the data, which includes details on the circumstances of deaths and what in a victim's life may have led to them.
Establishing a why will help people identify who to target prior to them taking their own life.
That data helps researchers hone in on the root causes of these violent deaths. And Wilson says the program has already made an impact in other parts of the country.
An example was Oregon found out that a lot of people dying by suicide in their state were recently evicted. They were then able to take steps in addressing that concern.
George Austin from the Idaho Suicide Hotline says ignoring the problem just isn't an option.
Since the early 90s, the rate of suicide in the United States has just jumped incredibly. So right now, you're more likely in Idaho to know somebody who's died by suicide than who's died in a traffic accident.
Researchers hope with more data, they can stem that tide. For Guns and America, I'm Heath Drusen.
Guns in America and our partner station KERA are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsinamerica.org. Okay, we have this thing called social media that happens all the time, and that doesn't sound like Wells Dunbar to you, does it? Well, in for Wells Dunbar is the Standard Zone, Michael Marks, monitoring social media on this Tuesday. Is there a lot going on out there?
A little bit. On Capitol Hill, certainly, David.
Yeah.
Two White House officials who listened in on a call between President Trump and Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky testifying today in front of the House Intelligence Committee for impeachment hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Those witnesses, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, staffer for the National Security Council and a White House expert on Ukraine. Jennifer Williams, also Ukraine expert, advisor to Vice President Pence. Again, the question here, whether President Trump conveyed to President Zelensky that aid to Ukraine would be contingent upon an investigation into Joe Biden's son's activities in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman reported part of the contents of this conversation, saying, quote, "What I heard was inappropriate." Williams also saying this morning she found the call peculiar because it involved a domestic political matter. In College Station, Robert Ralston, he's been taking a look at all this. He says on Twitter, he finds Vidman's testimony to be credible, certainly not clear. Quite a few tweets about his nervousness, in fact. Others, though, like Carlos Cruz in San Antonio, have a different opinion on his believability. He tweets, "Vindman is a professional liar. What you think seems to be where you fall on the spectrum."
We'd love to know what you think, Texas. You know what to do, right? You just jump on your social media platform of choice and you look up Texas Standard. And Michael Marks is looking for you. He's going to be back in about 35 minutes or so with more of your comments. Howdy, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Actress, comedian, and author Cristela Alonzo now has a little piece of the Rio Grande Valley not many can claim to possess. On Friday in McAllen, at the conclusion of a performance of her stand-up comedy My Affordable Care Act, McAllen's mayor pro tem surprised Cristela Alonzo with a key to the city, a ceremonial honor bestowed on valued members of the community who are distinguished celebrities, Alonzo qualifying on both counts. Talking with Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leaños Jr. before the performance, Alonzo seemed to draw clear distinction between where she lives today, Los Angeles, and the meaning of home, what many Texans call the Valley.
It's important to talk about how this community, even if you don't know each other, people will really come out and support you because that's kind of how they were raised. When I moved away, I'm like, everybody needs to know about this place because it's so special.
The city of McAllen says the recognition celebrates her role as the first Latina to create, write, and star in network sitcom, Cristela. It also recognizes Alonzo as the first Latina to star as a lead in a Disney Pixar movie in Cars 3 as Cruz Ramirez. After receiving the key, Alonzo took to Twitter, thanking her late mother for all of her sacrifices and saying this is her key. Earlier this year, in a conversation with the Standard's own Kristen Cabrera, Alonzo also talked about her mom.
I end up having to go to Texas to say goodbye to her. And she got better. So she told me that she got better because I was there. Like, no pressure, but a hell of a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Like, no big deal, but you saved my life. You know?
You can hear that story at texasstandard.org. All you have to do is search Christella.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Most of us can tell a story about how the airlines failed to deliver a piece of luggage on time or lost it entirely, but what if the airlines damaged or lost the only means of daily transportation you had? According to an investigative report by our next guest, each day the airlines lose or damage 29 wheelchairs or electric scooters used by the disabled. That's each day. Now, new data released this week by the U.S. Department of Transportation indicates that nearly 8,000 mobility aids were damaged or lost in the first 9 months of this year. And who foots the bill for the damage? Huh. These are among the questions Jamie Frazier has been looking into for her Flying While Disabled series. She's an investigative reporter for Gannett. Jamie, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
While a piece of damaged piece of luggage is obviously pretty easily replaced, some of these mobility aids can cost upwards of $20,000. Who does foot the bill if a wheelchair or a motorized transportation scooter gets damaged?
An airline is required under law to cover the cost of damage, but that frequently can take months to get those repairs done or the replacement ordered. And some travelers simply don't have that time. I mean, if you're relying on this to get from A to B, to do your job, to, you know, get your kids to school in the morning, you can't be without your legs, so to speak, for months or weeks. So a lot of people foot the bill out of pocket at first and have mixed results getting reimbursement. Other times, the airlines have refused to pay for repairs. And it's a system that hasn't had a ton of enforcement by the Department of Transportation.
You know, you talk to some of the airlines and they point out that damage to some of these devices is anywhere between 1% and 3% of all the wheelchairs they transport. They have to transport a lot. That doesn't sound so bad on the surface. I mean, given the overall scale of how many of these devices have to travel by plane.
Yeah, if you look at it as a percentage, it doesn't seem like a lot. But if you talk to an individual, you know, that's a loss of independence. It can cause major health complications and even put them in the hospital. As one traveler put it, you know, if we were losing, you know, this many pets every day, the country would be in an uproar. Another way to look at it is every time you fly, that risk compounds. So a single flight, you might have a 1.6% risk. But if you take four flights, which is, you know, two flights to your destination and two flights home, your risk is 6%. If you fly once a month for work, your chance of having your mobility aid damaged or lost is 32% for the
year. Wow. If you fly once a month for work.
Yeah. And that's if you're, that's at the industry average. If you're flying with an airline that has a worse record, for instance, with American, which, you know, it's 3.7% per flight. Mm-hmm. But if you fly once a month for work with American, your risk could be 60% in the year that your mobility aid will be damaged. And if you think about that in able-bodied terms, you know, if you were flying and there was a 60% chance that one of your legs could be broken, would you be flying?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. The Americans with Disabilities Act was passed back in 1990. And frankly, I'm surprised that we're just talking about these numbers now. Has the data been out there and no one's been looking at it, or what? What's going on?
Well, there are two interesting points on this. One is airlines are exempt from the Americans with Disabilities Act. They're covered by a separate federal law, the Air Carrier Access Act, which was passed in 1986. And so there are different standards of accessibility on planes than there are for buses or buildings or pretty much anywhere else in American life. And how often mobility aids like this are damaged has been tracked by some airlines internally for years, but federal officials have never required it to be reported to them until this past December.
What does this speak to? Because it seems like an unusually high number of these devices are in fact being damaged.
Sure. It depends a little bit on who you talk to in terms of why this happens so much. You know, there are lots of folks that in the disability community who think it's exactly that. There's just a lack of appreciation for the seriousness of these devices or just misunderstanding about how delicate or fragile they can be. Some of it has to do with the design of airplanes itself and the constraints that workers are put under. So for instance, almost every cargo hold door is smaller, not as tall as a power chair is. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So they have to tilt these 300-pound pieces of equipment on their side to get them through the cargo door.
I see.
And the side is where some of this delicate electronic components are.
Right. You know, the nation's bus transit systems often allowed disabled passengers to ride the bus in their own wheelchair strapped down by the bus driver. Is that a better option for air travel? I mean, should planes be forced to accommodate travelers in that way, or is that just impractical?
So it's a question that new federal advisory committee is going to be looking at in the next several months. There has been some crash safety testing by a nonprofit called All Wheels Up, mm-hmm. Which is, shown that it can be just as safe as sitting in a passenger seat.
Jamie Fraser continues to look into this story. Flying While Disabled is the title of the series, and she's an investigative reporter for Gannett. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Jamie, thanks so much for sharing with us your findings. We certainly do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, I'm just thinking, you probably have had some kind of related experience. Maybe you know somebody who has. You have a friend or a family member. Well, we'd love to hear that story, and we add it to our ongoing coverage of this issue, among others. You can always reach out to us, texasstandard@kut.org is probably the best way to do so. Just mention something about our story on travel and accommodation for the disabled. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. Stay with us.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The chair of the Texas Democratic Party is backing Julian Castro's call to change the order of the primary states. The Democratic presidential hopeful has argued first in the nation states, Iowa and New Hampshire, are not representative of the country because they lack demographic diversity. Iberto Hinojosa discussed the issue today on the program Democracy Now!
Texas is the second largest state in the country. It is probably the most diverse state in the country. 40% of the population in the state is Hispanic. 15% is either African American or Asian American. We are a majority minority state, as is California and New Mexico. And yet, you know, we have to wait until the process in Iowa and in New Hampshire completes itself.
More than 90% of the population in Iowa and New Hampshire is white. The state's largest farm organization is urging rural Texans to make sure they're counted on the 2020 census. As Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports, the Texas Farm Bureau says the residents are at risk of losing representation on the state and national level.
The census helps determine the number of seats each state will have in Congress, and preliminary estimates show Texas could pick up 3 seats. It'll also help in the redrawing of state legislative districts. So Gary Joyner with the Texas Farm Bureau says it's very important that rural Texans are counted.
In Texas, in the last several decades, we've seen declining numbers of representatives at the state house and those that are whose lines are drawn to include rural areas. So we're wanting to make sure that every rural resident is counted, that those households participate.
According to the state demographer, about 15% of Texans live in rural areas. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
80 acres of marshland along the Texas Gulf Coast will be protected as part of a nationwide effort to enhance coastal resiliency against the effects of rising sea levels and severe storms. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation announced 44 project grants on Monday, including $3 million for Swan Lake in Galveston County. The Wildlife Foundation's Erica Feller says the grants stem from a partnership between federal agencies and the private sector. They'll help fund mitigation projects from Alaska to Puerto Rico.
So like beaches, dunes, river deltas, wetlands, stuff like that. In places where communities have identified that they can make a meaningful contribution to reducing the risk of coastal flooding, and where they'll also provide benefits for fish and wildlife.
The Texas General Land Office is contributing an additional $9.5 million for the Swan Lake project. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. SierraNevada.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The Houston Astros may have lost this year's World Series to the Washington Nationals, but at least they'll always have 2017, that one shining season where it all came together, an untarnished title that no one can ever take away, right? Well, that was the thought until recently, when a report from the sports site The Athletic included allegations from members of that 2017 Astros team that the club illegally stole signs to tip batters off as to what pitch would come next. It's a scandal that Bob Nightingale has been tracking for USA Today, where he's a baseball columnist. Bob, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Let's establish the nuts and bolts of this first. How did the Astros get caught allegedly cheating?
Well, there have been allegations for a long time, but yet now a former player, Mike Fiers, pitcher now with Oakland Athletics, he was the one who told the Athletic that yes, we legally stole signs. We had cameras in center field that relayed to us what pitch was coming, using center field cameras. Then with the feeds to the dugout, then they would tell the hitters what pitch is coming by banging on a trash can, whistling, even some kind of buzzer mechanisms. You can steal signs by your eyeballs and everything else, but you can't do it electronically.
Okay, I want to make sure I understand something here. Stealing signs obviously isn't new to baseball. Teams are always trying to do it. When you say that what's not fair is the electronics that are involved here, you're talking about like the camera at center field, right?
Right. You're not allowed to use those cameras. Yeah, correct.
So if you
you can't have a live feed to the dugout, you know, where the camera feed is focused on the opposing catcher and then relaying those signs back.
Is that it? I mean, but otherwise, if you had someone who was dedicated to following signs and they were signaling someone in the dugout and the dugout signaled somebody else, that's all okay?
Yeah, that's legal. That may be unethical, but it's legal. So you can have take a little step further. You can actually have a guy in the bullpen use binoculars and look at the signs and do a signal from the bullpen and send them in that way. Just not using electronic equipment.
I don't want to be cynical about this, but come on, what's the difference between high-powered optics and a video camera?
Yeah, just the video cameras, I think it's gone too far. I mean, ever since 2017, after that World Series with the Astros and Dodgers, they have security guy on the bench and one in their video room as well, monitoring this to make sure no one's doing anything illegal.
So where was this camera located, and why would nobody see it? I mean, you've got all these eyeballs trained on what's happening on the diamond. How could you miss a camera?
Well, those cameras are so small. I mean, I think things go on all the time, and nobody knows it. I mean, people used to be paranoid even on the bench, opposing benches, thinking, okay, is someone stealing signs here? Why is that camera pointing at me? That sort of thing. But there's a lot of little cameras in ballparks.
All right, so how have the Astros responded to these allegations? And we should underscore here, these are allegations about the 2017 season, is that right?
Correct. Yeah, so far nothing in 2018 or 19 when the ban was imposed. It was already there, but the Boston Red Sox are found using Apple Watches in 2017. New York Yankees were using a computer screen. That was illegal. they both had their, you know, wrists slapped on it. But after 17, they said, you know, hey, this can't happen. So it was done during the World Series. And people don't think the Houston Astros are the only ones doing it, but they're the ones been under investigation.
So what have the Astros had to say about these allegations?
So far, some brief denials, and now it's just been radio silence saying, hey, we'll cooperate with investigators and see what happens here. So they're interviewing, you know, former players from that team, current players from the team, former scouts, things like that. So anybody involved in 2017, MLB wants to talk to them.
What penalties might the Astros face here?
Well, certainly financial penalties, but more important, the Astros would be loss of draft picks, loss of international, you know, spending money, that sort of thing. You know, they could suspend people too, if they believe that it came from upstairs, or even the manager or coaching staff could do some penalties there and have some brief suspensions. But the big thing would be the draft picks.
Any chance the World Series title could be revoked altogether?
No. Yeah, it's not the NCAA. They can't do that. So it will always stand, but it will obviously be tarnished, if this is the case.
Bob Nightingale is a baseball columnist for USA Today. We've been talking with him about an Astros cheating scandal, which is sending shockwaves out of Minute Maid Park and well beyond. Bob, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. Very interesting stuff.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
Hey, this is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. When you think of computer hackers, what part of the country comes to mind? Silicon someplace or another, perhaps? What sort of people doing what sorts of things? Well, plenty of tech enthusiasts wear the name hacker with pride. And as KERA's Galilee Abdullah reports, in North Texas, there's a vibrant hacker community.
Dozens of people have gathered at a Korean karaoke bar in Dallas, not to sing, but to meet up with other hackers. The Dallas Hackers Association meets here monthly. People give fast-paced talks on cybersecurity, it's a chance to network, and laptops are set up for Capture the Flag, which is kind of a game where hackers hunt down computer bugs. When Dallas Hackers Association launched 6 years ago, only a handful of people came.
There's a lot of security needs here, a lot of security folks, but as it becomes more popular, a crowd, nothing attracts a crowd like a crowd, and it's just been blowing up.
That's the founder of Dallas Hackers Association. He goes by Wirefall. Some hackers conceal their names for security reasons. They want to avoid being doxxed or having their identities exposed by other hackers for malicious reasons. Some hackers don't share their names to protect the businesses that hire them to test their networks. And North Texas has grown into a hacker hub. Some say that's because lots of telecommunications and information technology companies are based here. And some even call Dallas-Fort Worth a Silicon Prairie. Philip Wiley teaches ethical hacking and web application penetration testing at Richland College.
There's a lot of companies here, and a lot of companies have their headquarters, and you have some large insurance companies. There's a lot of business here, and when you got business, you got information that needs to be secured.
Some may think hacking is just bypassing security or cracking a password, but hacking is really taking something and stretching it beyond its intended means. That's according to a hacker who goes by Tinker. He's also a co-organizer of Dallas Hackers Association.
I hack into computers, and I break into buildings. As I'm able to do that, I go to my clients who have hired me to hack into their own computers. I go to them, I show them how I did it so they can fix it so the actual malicious actors can't do it as well.
So there are all types of hackers. Corporate hackers, criminal hackers, the enthusiasts. For those who want to learn more about ethical hacking, Wiley, the Richland College professor, started the Pwn School Project. It's a free educational cybersecurity meetup.
I have students that come through my class that may be the first class they take at the college. But hacking is just so interesting to people. Some of my students were asking, where do I go to learn past this class?
Wiley was at the karaoke bar for Dallas Hackers Association. Larcy Robertson was also there. She's a cyber threat intelligence manager for a marketing company in Dallas.
Coming to the normal meetups with Dallas Hackers and some other ones, it's typically 95% men.
Robertson started the Dallas chapter of Women of Security.
To get more women involved in not only the job field, but their communities. And so you could go to Dallas Hackers and not sit by yourself and have somebody have your back.
So the reality of tech and cybersecurity? Most in the industry are white men. Eden A.P. Cohn is a corporate hacker. He was in Fort Worth at B-Sides DFW. It's a security conference.
When I go to conferences or training, I'm typically like the only black person there. A lot of times with cybersecurity, a lot of people overall feel like it's over the head. But then also for, you know, the black community, it's not a common thing to do. So if they can see another black person doing it, I think they'll feel like, you know what, this is something that's possible because I see somebody else doing it.
Diversity matters in the hacking world because cybersecurity risks affect everyone. Things like massive data breaches have become the norm. Again, Tinker.
A lot of people get labeled as paranoid when they say, oh, the government's listening to everything I say, or my phone's tracking me, etc. The truth is everybody's information is being sopped up and put into big computers.
Information that's being tracked and could be hacked into. As breaches continue and technology evolves, hackers say interest in hacking is growing, and so will the local hacker scene. I'm Galilee Abdullah in Dallas.
About 2 years ago, federal authorities slammed Texas for putting an illegal cap on special ed. Since then, public schools across the state have been trying to catch up and serve all children with disabilities. But in an investigation with the Houston Chronicle, Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee finds one group of schools with even further to go.
Like many 13-year-old boys, Nicholas Davis likes to build things. He's on the living room couch, folding paper with precise creases.
You should end up having a paper boat.
Nicholas has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and activities like this help.
I feel calm. I feel like nobody can, like, disrupt me from doing what I'm doing.
In class, it's hard for Nicholas to focus. In elementary school, he was diagnosed with ADHD and depression. So his public school in Aldean assigned him an aide to help him stay on track. Then the family moved to Houston.
It was like a roller coaster ride.
His mom, Brittany Miller, thought the neighborhood middle school wasn't safe, so she turned to charter schools. But instead of support, Miller says the charters denied Nicholas special ed services.
It's just heartbreaking to be told, no, we can't. And it's like, if I give up, it hurts my kid. But it's like I'm fighting and I haven't won yet.
At one Houston charter school, the new Yellowstone College Prep, Miller says she asked them to test Nicholas for special ed because his therapist believes he's on the autism spectrum. But she says the school shrugged it off.
Yeah, so they said that it was a maturity thing. Basically, his grades don't say special ed.
At another charter school, Yes Prep, Miller asked for accommodations like Nicholas had at his old public school. There, she says, Yes Prep administrators told her
that this was a charter school and they don't typically have to follow those guidelines.
That's not true. Charter schools have to follow federal disability laws. While they may have different oversight and more flexibility than traditional public schools, they're still taxpayer funded. When I asked Yellowstone and Yes Prep about this, they both told me they couldn't comment on individual cases, but maintain they follow federal law. Advocates, though, say this family story is all too familiar. Dustin Reinders is with Disability Rights Texas.
You know, it's nothing new in the special ed world. We've always known that families are counseled out, denied admission, and pushed out if they sneak in the door somehow.
State data show that charters in Texas serve lower portions of special needs children than traditional public schools, and the gap is getting bigger. Take Yes Prep. Its share of special ed students is less than half the national average. Reinders says one reason could be that Texas charters have more discretion in admissions, for example, looking at a potential student's discipline records. Charter school leaders disagree and say the numbers don't tell the full story. Starley Coleman directs the Texas Charter Schools Association.
We can't make an assumption that there's something wrong.
Coleman says special needs parents may be turned off by many charters' smaller size or less experienced teaching staff. Still, the low numbers have caught the attention of state administrators. Deputy Education Commissioner Matt Montaño says they've stepped up monitoring and communication with charter schools.
The concern is how do we make sure that they know what they're supposed to do?
For Brittany Miller, she's enrolled her son Nicholas in yet another charter school, his third for eighth grade.
I have to find a little faith in something only because I don't have another option.
Though she says she's not holding out much hope. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. On Friday, Clint Lawrence, an Army first lieutenant who had served 6 years of a 19-year sentence for ordering his platoon to gun down a group of unarmed civilians in Afghanistan, was pardoned by President Trump. Speaking on Fox News, the Texan looked directly into the cameras and spoke to the president. "I love you, sir," he said. Over the weekend, the commander-in-chief also granted a full pardon to an Army Special Forces officer who faced murder charges for killing an unarmed Afghan civilian, and dropped the demotion handed down to a Navy SEAL for his role in a war crime carried out against a teenaged ISIS fighter in Iraq. Appropriate? Jeffrey Korn is Vincent and Elkins Professor of Law at South Texas College of Law, Houston. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your reaction to the military pardons that have been receiving such attention from the Trump administration.
Well, I mean, my reaction is very negative. I think it's very unfortunate that the president would ignore the very carefully articulated advice of his senior military commanders and of the Secretary of Defense. And at the very basic level, my view as a retired Army officer and the former special advisor to the Army Judge Advocate for Law of War Matters is that if we trust our commanders with the lives of our sons and daughters, then we need to trust them when they make disciplinary decisions, especially related to battlefield misconduct.
Is there a corollary with what happened with President Barack Obama and commuting the bulk of Chelsea Manning's prison sentence?
Well, first off, recognize a commutation is quite different than a pardon. So I think if the president, in the case of Lieutenant Lawrence, had decided to commute the remainder of his sentence, that would have been more tolerable. I think that it would have been more understandable. A pardon absolves these individuals, and in one case, absolved an individual who had not even faced trial yet, who may very well have been acquitted by a military jury. So the thing that's troubling is the intervention in the process and the implicit, if not explicit, message that if you engage in conduct that crosses the line of propriety, even in war, there's no consequence for it.
Do you think that President Trump has miscalculated the reaction from his base? I mean, there's a lot of commentary that this move is precisely calculated to improve his chances for come November 2020.
No, actually, I don't think he's miscalculated. I think he played right to it. But I think that that is a reflection of the reality that many people who find this appealing don't truly understand why it's important to hold service members accountable when they breach these obligations. And, you know, one thing I'd ask your listeners to consider is, what does this say to the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of American service members who held that line, who assumed enormous mortal risk because they understood that there were lines that they could not cross in war, and they and their leaders respected those rules to do the right thing in the most demanding and difficult situation? And I think that we should think about the message it sends to them.
The argument, of course, on the other side might be something along the lines of, well, this does respect the chain of command. The executive branch for more than 200 years, the White House said, has used its authority to offer second chances to individuals that president deems deserving, including those in uniform.
Unquestionable that the president has the legal authority to do this, but I'm a law professor and I teach a class on prosecutorial ethics. And one of the most important principles I teach my students, which is a principle I learned from my leaders in the military, is that just because something's legal doesn't mean it's always right. Of course, if it's illegal, it's wrong. But if it's legal, there are other considerations that factor into the exercise of that discretion. And the fact is that the Secretary of Defense, knowing this was coming, according to news reports, met with the president and urged him in the strongest of terms not to take this action. Now, that's not the Secretary of Defense just making this up out of whole cloth. That's after careful deliberation on these cases, talking to the judge advocates general, talking to the senior military commanders in the Pentagon, and presenting a consensus view that this is ultimately contrary to the interests of our armed forces and our nation. And the president, who has no experience commanding troops in combat, decided otherwise.
Jeffrey Korn is the Presidential Research Professor of Law, South Texas College of Law in Houston. Professor Korn, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Michael Marks is in for our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, today. What are Texans talking about out there on social media?
A tough time for the Houston Nine as of late, David. Mm. These cheating allegations dogging the Astros we heard about earlier in the show, festering for the better part of a week now. Have you seen any of the videos kind of breaking down how this might have happened?
No, I haven't, but now you got me wanting to search YouTube.
So you can, it shows, you know, a pitch sequence where you can hear these kind of big whoomp sounds right after the catcher signals to the pitcher. And the number of sounds corresponds to the type of pitch. Maybe,
you don't say.
2 for a fastball, 1 for a curveball,
really?
None for a changeup, that sort of thing.
So what do you think they're like a big
garbage
trash can or something?
Maybe. I mean, sometimes they're whistles, sometimes, you know, there's all sorts of stuff you get hit in those dugouts, David.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, to my eyes and ears, to many on the internet, they appear fairly incriminating. However, we should also issue the caveat that it is the internet. These sort of things can be manipulated.
But wait a minute. We just got through talking in our interview. We were talking about, like, the part that was not permitted was the high-tech stuff, the cameras.
I think that is where the rubber hits the road, I believe, for Major League Baseball. You know, there's the old saying, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. And so there's a certain degree of that is accepted in baseball.
I've heard they say that in New England sometimes.
Certainly. I was curious how this is playing in Houston proper. A few select tweets here from the Bayou City. Brant Croucher writes, I feel like this has kind of taken a life of its own. I agree that the Astros should be punished if they are found to have broken actual rules. I think other teams should too, but this witch hunt is a little nutty.
Did he say witch hunt?
That is the exact term.
It's got to be a popular word of late, hasn't it? Witch hunt. Before you know it, they'll be quid pro quoing or something.
Lord. Also, this from SB12 in Sugarland. Not quite as, or a little more dubious of the claims, I should say. They tweet, somebody is really out to get the Astros. Mm. I don't know who the Astros made mad, shall we say, but these fabrications, he calls them, are getting ridiculous. And this from Kelso2002. I don't think any fans of the Astros don't think they cheat. I just don't want to hear the self-righteous indignation from fans of other cheating teams. It's baseball. I don't know if there's any Astros fans out there. I believe that there are some Astros fans who believe that they're not cheating. And it may exist in a little bit of a gray area. I don't know. Hopefully Major League Baseball does. And we'll find out certainly in the next few days, few weeks.
I'm trying to hold back on so many jokes that are coming to my head, and it just would not be appropriate. But the music is going to save us all.
I'm distracted by this version of the theme.
Yeah, I know. It's a different sort of theme, isn't it? Got a little bit of that piano jam going on there. Hammond organ or something. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast. But we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. On behalf of the entire Texas Standard team, I'm Dave Brown along with Michael Marks, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.